The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Let's start with a cultural reference, if people don't mind. How many people have seen the movie Wolf Warrior 2? Anyone heard of the movie Wolf Warrior 2? Came out, it was a sequel to Wolf Warrior 1, came out last year. I mean, it was the second highest grossing movie in a single market. No? It made $845 billion. It's second to Star Wars, The Force Awakens. People heard about that movie?
Yes.
Okay. I thought I was getting into like the socialists don't watch movies, they don't care about Han Solo, Leia, etc. So anyway, there's probably a reasonable reason people haven't heard of Wolf Warrior 2, because the single market, it was the second highest grossing movie and was China. So there's not, it's you can still get it on Amazon if you want. But it was interesting because the New Yorker had a whole, this writer, Evan Ausnos, he interviewed the director, Wu Jing, who also stars in the movie. It's basically just an action movie about a former PLA, People's Liberation Army soldier, Ling Feng. And in the interview, Ausnos focuses on one scene of the movie where Ling Feng and an American doctor are in this jeep, you know, trying to escape danger, and the American doctor is trying to call the consulate to ask for help, and she gets a voicemail saying, "Unfortunately, we are closed." And then Ling Feng turns to the doctor and says, "Do you think the U.S. Marines are going to save you? Where are they now?" And so Ausnos asked the director, like, what's that? What about that scene? Like, do people around the world feel that the United States is just not there? And the director interestingly replies that, you know, he's reading too much into that scene. It's not, it was just a joke. Don't think that, you know, we think that America is not there. But it's interesting that the movie was, you know, one of the biggest movie ever to be released in China. It was hugely popular. And it's about an ex-soldier who finds himself in this fictional African country guarding a Chinese business venture, and he ends up fighting on the side of the country's government against Western-backed rebels. And Ausnos talks about the movie as China asserting itself as a competent and ethical international economic and military power. And it's understandable. In the final battle, a villain played by American actor Frank Grillo tells Lung, "People like you will always be inferior to people like me, so get used to it." And so Lung responds by beating him to death with his bare hands and says, "That's fucking history." So for the liberal readers like the New Yorker magazine, there's an understandable focus on this fear of a scary, you know, Chinese Rambo, if you will, that's, you know, doing something different than Rambo did, which was killing commies in Vietnam or Afghanistan, because the U.S. is the rightful policeman of the world. But it's interesting, if you look at the movie, I don't think that's the only reason it was popular. I'm sure that's probably the main reason, but the movie starts with Lung Feng bringing the dead body of a deceased comrade back to a village, and the village has been torn down, the house has been raised by a real estate company in China, and Lung Feng ends up fighting with the boss of the real estate guy and kicks him through a police car window and kills him. And so I think there's other things that are a little bit deeper there about why it's popular, a popular movie in China. Now, this movie may not be as subversive as Box Trolls or Coco. I think, you know, I have a 10-year-old that I live with. He likes to watch those kind of movies, so that's the ones I can reference. But I think its popularity is due to more than its nationalist message. So that's just my opening to say that China is a big subject. There's a lot that can be talked about in an hour and a half, and I'm going to try and keep this to the following points. The first one is, what process has allowed China to occupy its current position in the world? Secondly, what is Xi Jinping, you know, the leader of China, what is his vision for China? Thirdly, how does China's rise directly relate to the U.S.'s global position? And finally, what are the weak links in the chain? So to start with, China's self-described century of humiliation began in 1839 with the first Opium War. The Opium War ended in 1842 with the Treaty of Nanjing. And this is when Hong Kong was taken as a colony by the British, and five of their port cities along the coast were all established as international points of trade. So while capitalists today are using tariffs and the WTO to settle trade disagreements, in the good old days of the British Empire, they took a page out of the Portuguese and became the leading supplier of opium to the Chinese market. the British East India Company established a monopoly on opium cultivation in neighboring India and subcontracted out the transportation of opium into China. By 1838, 5.6 million pounds of opium were being brought into China on a yearly basis, which is a lot of opium. And so, what is this about? Are the British genetically evil? That's not really the full answer. But it was about a trade deficit. That's what they were interested in. The European markets had a huge demand for Chinese products like tea, silk, pottery, and apparently the Chinese market was not as interested in maybe products from Britain, wool, you know, versus silk, right? You know, British food versus Chinese food. To be serious, maybe the beer would be something they'd be interested in. But the British were producing a lot of iron. You could say that iron could have been traded in China for those products. But the iron is heavy. I mean, you want to pull that shit from Britain all the way down to China, that would take a lot of resources. It's much easier just to grow drugs next door and sell them to the Chinese. And the reason that I go into this detail is to point out that no matter how much class society changes, some of the main dynamics remain the same. Going to war to open markets in a foreign country, saturating a region with an addictive drug, these things are still happening today. For all the criticism that is leveled against the devious Chinese, stealing ideas, not making honest deals, being aggressive militarily, you don't have to wonder too long where any of these ideas came from. So this process goes on, going back to the Opium War, for some time, switching out various actors and levels of atrocities. You know, the Germans, the Americans, the Japanese were all involved in looting and pillaging China. And this party comes to an abrupt end in 1949, when a popular revolution defeats the colonial powers, followed by a defeat of the nationalists. Now, I'm not going to go into that story because Mike Corwin tomorrow is going to be giving a talk on the tragedy of the Chinese Revolution at 2 o'clock, because people should go to that. But it's a key history to understand not only what happened with the 1949 revolution, but it says a lot about the politics and the strategy of the Communist International in the midst of a struggling Soviet government trying to find a path forward following the defeats of revolution in Europe. So people should definitely go to that meeting. So suffice it to say that the 49 revolution was not a socialist revolution, it was a nationalist revolution. We support that. It removed the colonial powers and replaced them with the Chinese ruling class, and a bizarre one, kind of, because it was a class society where the vast majority of the Chinese were farmers and a growing working class. But it was bizarre in the sense that it was had the language of socialism stamped on the emblem of a class society, much like you would stamp a Versace symbol on a bag. That's not a good maybe example. I don't buy that kind of stuff, so I don't know what the market on this. But anyway, it's like a stamp. It wasn't really a socialist society. And it was very strange. I happened to be living in China when I was about 10 in the late 80s, and we went on this one trip with my family to Beijing, and they had this huge Kentucky Fried Chicken right in the middle of downtown Beijing. This is about 80, 87, 88. And so you have the Forbidden City in the middle of downtown China, where the emperor used to live. There's the Tiananmen Gate. This is all built in like 1420. It's some old shit. In the middle of that, you have the mausoleum to Mao Zedong. His body. You can go. I don't know what they preserved it with, but it works. It's still there in the middle of, in just south of Tiananmen Square. And then, like, literally a 5-minute walk from that is a 3-story Kentucky Fried Chicken that's been there since like the middle 80s. And there was a huge statue, I don't know if it's still there, of Colonel Sanders like facing off with Mao or whatever. It was very bizarre. But that's basically the history of China in a nutshell right there. You go from an imperial power to a nationalist revolution, and let's have some chicken, you know. It's all very simple. But anyway, so economic development was already well underway before the Kentucky Fried Chicken showed up in China. Foreign investment in China started early as 1979, just some years after Mao's death. And it was throughout the 80s that the development continued, mainly in large cities along the coast and in special economic zones. These things kind of bumped along at a moderate pace until there was an economic crisis in 88, causing inflation uncertainty. And it was an excuse of a death of a moderate party official who was critical of corruption then that became the pretense for a student occupation in Tiananmen Square in 1989, which people assume are familiar with. They had a hunger strike where hundreds of students became hospitalized, but the real problem for the, as far as the Chinese state was concerned, was when workers and soldiers started marching on the square in support of the students, and that's when the government basically closed ranks and sent the tanks in to shut down everything on June 4th. Now, the Tiananmen Square protest in some way was caused by the earlier reforms that were happening in China, and I think it spurned further reforms. It was a product of a youth wanting reforms and economic progress faster than could the state could dole them out, and it was also a sign to the ruling class they needed to do more faster if they wanted to stay in the driver's seat. But as far as the international community, they didn't really have a problem with Tiananmen. Less than a month after the tanks rolled in, the British and the Japanese, you know, I don't think there's any accident there, opened up their offices in China again, and by mid-August, the loans of other investor countries were flowing. It didn't take long for their tears to dry for the dead Chinese to start doing their real business in China. And so from 92 onward, I think, is the kind of next phase where there was rapid development in China. And it was done on a very simple basis. Open up factories in coastal cities, hire migrant laborers for cheap, restrict the rights of those workers who were coming in based on their rural status, and began to wind down the state enterprises, which made up what was called the Iron Rice Bowl. Deng Xiaoping called it socialism with Chinese characteristics. I'm not sure what that means. But it was really about bringing explicit market dynamics into the economy. There was some talk about how economic growth was needed before a more egalitarian socialism could be instituted later. It's basically saying there'll be pie in the sky when you die. You know, just work hard now, and then some socialist future will reap the benefits. And in 2001, China was welcomed to the WTO. And neoliberalism was fully flowering within the Chinese economy. In 2016, China was a recipient of $139 billion in foreign direct investment. So there's huge amounts of capital flowing into China. But most of them are coming from what you would see as like the core countries, Hong Kong, Japan, United States, Virgin Islands. Virgin Islands it's kind of weird to think about Virgin Islands. It's about a quarter the size of Chicago. You know, how many Chinese products get flooded into the Virgin Islands? But just opaque banking and, you know, free market. That's why the Virgin Islands is a big investor in China. It's not really the Virgin Islands. But anyway, so the point is there's these main countries are the ones that are investing in China. It's very well integrated into the worldwide system of production. And this was made possible through transferring millions of workers, millions of farmers from the countryside into the cities to work in factories. And this brings me to my second point, which is what does Xi Jinping represent? So Xi Jinping came into power as the General Secretary of the Communist Party, Chairman of the Central Military Commission, and in 2013 he was elected President of the People's Republic. I took one look at a book written by some Chinese academics about from Tsinghua University, like the equivalent of Harvard or Yale or whatever, and they go into detail about what his philosophy is, and they talk, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it basically just talks about how he's all about the people, he's supporting the people, he wants to develop the economy, the 13th five-year plan is about the people, and Xi has resurrected an old idea that was made by previous Chinese leaders about the twin centenaries, 1921 and 1949. 1921 was the founding of the Communist Party in China, 49 is the Communist Revolution. And they said on the 100th anniversary of those two things, they want to have China make major steps forward. By 2021, it's supposed to be a moderately prosperous country. So I don't know, moderately is they're kind of setting the bar low, I guess. But what they mean is they want to double the income of people in China by 2021, and if you look at the World Bank estimates right now, they're on target to do that. By 2049, they want China to become a fully developed nation, and Xi has encompassed this as part of what he calls the Chinese dream. And the Chinese dream has four main parts: strong China, civilized China, harmonious China, beautiful China, you know, good environment, all the rest of it. And some would argue that Xi's vision is the throwback to Confucianism, which is about respecting your parents, respecting the hierarchy of the state, and obedience. And this was, Confucianism was really the ideology of the Chinese Empire for most of its existence, which is, you know, a top-down society. So there was another document that kind of further expounds on what Xi means by his Chinese dream. He made this speech in Tanzania, for example, right after he was elected. He says, the Chinese and African people should enhance solidarity, cooperation, mutual support, and assistance to realize our respective dreams. We should also work with the rest of the world to realize the dream of a world of enduring peace and common prosperity, and to make new and bigger contributions to the peace and progress of humanity. So that's interesting that he's going to Africa with that message. He then spoke, there's a speech they recount that he made to the All China Federation of Trade Unions, where he talks about we should unite China's millions of people, turn their wills into a stronghold, make unremitting efforts to realize the Chinese dream of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. Happiness does not fall from the sky, and dreams do not automatically come true. As the saying goes, empty verbiage only harms the nation, whereas hard work makes the country prosper. So I think internationally you can see how Xi is projecting China as a benevolent world power, and internally it's hard work which is going to build the nation. There's an interesting side note. Someone sent me an article from the People's Weekly World. It's the newspaper of the Communist Party USA, and they sent two participants to Shenzhen to celebrate, where they had the Communist Party had a big celebration for Marx's 200th birthday. This is a birthday, yeah. And it'd be interesting to have what Karl Marx would think about Shenzhen, because Shenzhen is really an amazing story. In 1980, it was literally a cow town of about 30,000 people, and currently it's a major financial sector, homes of dozens of multinational corporations. It has the fourth tallest building in the entire world, one of the busiest container ports in the world, and home to 12.5 million people. I mean, all in a matter of 40 years. And this is just one example of how China has really exploded, its economy has really exploded. So anyway, the Weekly World, they interview An Jianhua, who was the international secretary of this All-China Federation of Trade Unions. And in discussing strikes with An, he says that the All-China Federation does not see strike tactics as necessarily the smartest one, given China's condition, the conditions of Chinese labor market. And An, they have a quote from him. He says, in China, we don't believe a strike is an efficient way to protect the interests of the working class. China is facing contradictions between the domestic working class and the domestic capitalist. But domestic capitalists also compete with foreign capitalists. So if there is a strike, it would be detrimental to both the workers and the capitalists in China. So I actually want to send a thank you card to this guy for really laying out in a nutshell the problems with nationalism, which is that the paramount concern of the nationalists is the need of the nation. That means that all class barriers are completely irrelevant. We have to close ranks and come together against the foreign powers, no matter how much you're getting screwed over by your local Chinese bosses. So I want to make a quick mention of the Belt and Road Initiative. It was formerly known as One Belt, One Road, which Xi unveiled in 2013. It's a multi-trillion-dollar plan to connect 60 countries through various land and sea corridors. The project is intricately linked to this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. This bank was started 2 years ago. It has $100 billion in capital already and 87 members. But the interesting thing is there's two countries that aren't part of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the United States and Japan. Those two countries are left out of that. And this is a direct competitor to the Asian Development Bank, which was started in the mid-60s, which is dominated by Japan and the United States. So if you combine these ideas of the two centenaries, the Chinese dream, the Belt and Road Initiative, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, it's pretty clear what Xi's vision involves. A national plan for China planned out 30 years in advance. They're not fooling around. So this takes me to the third point, U.S.-China relationships. In many ways, you could say Trump is a mirror to Xi's nationalism. Xi has the Chinese dream, where China takes a leadership place in the world, and Trump, he wants to make America great again. I guess one difference you could say is that Xi and the ruling class in China has a plan 30 years ahead of time. I'm not sure Trump knows what he's doing after lunch, besides eat it. But today, the tariffs went into place. People, I'm sure, have watched the news. $34 billion worth of Chinese goods are now going to be taxed at a higher rate. Fortunately, it doesn't include iPhones, plastic toys, and textiles. We can all keep shopping at the Toys R Us or whatever it's called now and get our cheap stuff. But the tariffs are going to impact steel, aluminum, solar panels, various components and machinery used by U.S. manufacturers. So I think it remains to be seen at what effects it's going to have, because there's a lot of U.S. manufacturers manufacturers that depend on those cheap Chinese products to make products that they sell here domestically. So the impact will be could be pretty great. I mean, Trump has threatened further tariffs, saying he could tax all, he might put on all $500 billion in goods, add tariffs. And Beijing has obviously responded by imposing tariffs on their own, on soybean, corn, rice, beef, pork. I mean, just think about where this stuff comes from. These are from farmers that are going to be impacted, and I think they're consciously targeting the states that voted for Trump to try and say, look whose side are you going to be on, the side of the Chinese or the side of Trump. And they're also consciously trying to be appearing as acting in self-defense from Trump, which is a pretty easy thing to do. The guy's a complete asshole. And so this ensuing trade war, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. And Trump is basically selling it, saying we have to stop the unfair trade practices and the theft of American intellectual property. I think the most dangerous thing is that there's union officials who are praising Trump. You had Trumka saying that this is a good thing, that Trump is protecting jobs. U.S. steel workers is doing the same thing. But this is, the reason it's worse is because it does the same thing as on from the All China Trade Union Federation doing. It's a nationalist thing that says, as workers, what we have in common with is our bosses. That's who our allies are, and not workers in other countries. And there's an unfortunate history to this rising nationalist sentiment amongst unions that could go into workers. After the demonization of Japanese car companies in the late 70s and early 80s, in Detroit, a laid-off Chrysler supervisor beat a man named Vincent Chen to death using a baseball bat, reportedly saying, "It's because of you little motherfuckers that were out of work." It didn't matter that Vincent wasn't Japanese, and even if he was Japanese, obviously his target should have been a fucking CEO of one of the auto companies, not some person wandering the streets of Detroit. And so there's definitely a danger to that we have to say something about. So time will tell. Again, get back to the point about the tariffs. Time will tell if these are effective. Trump should actually be thanking Obama, though, for in the 2008 financial crisis, bailing the banks out and doing absolutely nothing to help regular working people who really suffered. And so wages that we, while the boss's recovery has certainly happened, wages for most workers has not all recovered. And this is why the Taiwanese company Foxconn can build a factory now in Wisconsin. Trump and Scott Walker with the speaker were just there breaking ground last week in Wisconsin. And the thing that story's not being told as much is that they're giving $3 billion in tax breaks to Foxconn to come and build this factory there. It's going to take the state of Wisconsin until 2043 to recoup these costs that they're basically handing over to this company. So I think some question people have in their minds, will this trade war turn into a real war? I don't think in the near future that's likely to happen. China, first of all, doesn't have anywhere near the military strength that the U.S. has, although both have nuclear weapons. China is working on their sea fleet. But more important, I think that their economies are tightly intertwined with each other, which makes it difficult. But I think we should also remember that was an argument that the Second International kind of thought that would prevent World War I from happening, and obviously yep. World War I happened, despite the integration of those economies. But I think there is a section of the U.S. ruling class which supports Trump approach, but that's not the only idea out there. Going back to the article in the New Yorker, Osnos writes, and talks about the good old days of President Eisenhower, where the United States advanced international order based on free press and judiciary, human rights, free trade, protection of the environment. Does anyone have like an airplane bag I could throw up in? I mean, this is disgusting. I mean, I'm sure that this guy was like crying his eyes out when Trump said he was going to stop military exercises in South Korea. He's like, how dare you? Now the North Koreans are going to have free reign to take over the world. And so what I'm saying is that there's a liberal version of imperialism that's basically the same as the Trump version of imperialism. They all agree that U.S. has to be top dog. There's certainly disagreement about how to become the top dog, but they both agree to that. And I think this is an important thing to keep in mind when we work alongside allies on the left about the role of the Democratic Party. There was an article by a member of the Democratic Socialists of America in Washington, D.C. this last February. He argued that the U.S. economy must be organized in a democratic socialist way to more effectively compete with China. Now that's a little bit of a head scratcher because the DSA left the Second International, which I think is a good thing, that their convention last summer. But it seems like some of the politics of them, aligning with your old imperial power still remain. And but fortunately, it was actually quite a good response by another member of the DSA putting forward a position of worker solidarity, international solidarity with the Chinese. So this brings me to my final point. If we reject both projects, we don't side with either Washington or Beijing, then what do we see as the way forward? And I think that in a nutshell, we side with the workers in both countries to rise up and fight against our respective bosses. And so what are the prospects for that in China right now? First of all, I'll say that there are multiple weak links in the chain in China that are definitely going to have to deal with. The environmental crisis is insane. The amount of debt that the Chinese are in right now, they basically dealt the 2008 financial crisis by dumping all their capital reserves into all kinds of industries, factories, etc. And now that debt has to be called in. The growth in China has been slowing. There's a brewing demographic crisis in China. The one-child policy is catching up with them. There's going to be a huge amount of the population is going to be really old, and you're not going to have enough people to do work and take care of them. There's multiple points in China that could be open for struggle. Xi has succeeded in passing reforms that could allow him to go beyond two terms. People may have heard the last People's Congress. He basically took away the two term limit on the top office. But being the president for life also brings a certain amount of instability because it takes away even any semblance of democracy or and raises the specter, I think, of Mao again. So now, while strikes and protests in China are not at the same level as they were in 2016, but struggle does continue, even if on a lower level. There was one letter that was written by Zhang Yufan, who was a young activist and was jailed for his activity, and he writes, "I can see that in this world, exploitation and oppression have never disappeared. Many of my family members have been workers in state-owned enterprises. Thus, even when I was a child, I was aware of how the lifelong hard labor and contributions of old workers were expropriated. When the state-owned enterprises underwent reform and privatization, they were discarded and rendered precarious, abandoned to the will of society. Even larger in number, the vulnerable groups, those in coal mines owned by abusive bosses, on scaffolds and in sweatshops, their life trajectory was to first exhaust their youth, exhaust their whole lives, and exhaust the lives of their sons and daughters." So as it's in this country, there's a constant radicalization taking place in China. The conditions that the Chinese people live under are going to cause radicalization. And activity. There was just last month, there was the protest by crane operators in several regions. And this was actually unusual in the sense that they had coordination between several different cities. There were 19 provinces, and protests took place between 27 and 30 cities. They were basically going to threaten a strike, and the companies settled with them before because they didn't want to go there with them. And this is actually one of the first documented instances of a large-scale nationwide collective action by industrial workers in China for the past few decades. And in June, it was reported that the People's Liberation Army veterans held protests in several cities in recent weeks over what they say is mistreatment, poor job prospects, and inadequate benefits. Party leaders in Beijing were shocked in 2016 and early 2017 when about 1,000 veterans twice entered the capital and sat down in protest. This is the first time they sat down outside the PLA headquarters and the second time outside the party's anti-corruption agency. And China has more serving military personnel than in any other countries, and by official estimates, it has 57 million veterans, most of them recruited from villages and towns. So this makes another large pool for potential discontent. So I'm going to basically wrap up. The contradictions of China cannot last forever, but there's a rich history of struggles that will give them and us as well many opportunities to show solidarity, because I think that is the key thing that we can do here in this country. When Trump raises the specter of China bashing, we have to be saying we're in solidarity with Chinese workers. We stand in solidarity. We're against the nationalism that Trumpka and the steelworkers put forward. We stand with them, and we show them, and we show in concrete action that American workers stand solidarity with Chinese workers, because that's really the only way out of this mess into a better future. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.